This is Law and Disorder.
Recently, the New York City-based Brecht Forum had what can only be described as a suspicious burglary. And joining us will be attorney Margaret Ratner Kunstler to talk about that.
The more things change, the more they remain the same. Burglaries in the 70s, burglaries in the 80s, burglaries today, brought to you by your FBI.
We'll also be discussing last week's wave of immigration protests across the country. Over 500,000 demonstrators took to the streets in L.A. alone.
Mass demonstrations like we haven't seen in this country before, putting the Republicans to the test. Will they go for their ideology, or will they ultimately go for the votes?
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Today we'd like to update listeners on the latest phase of the cases going on in the Supreme Court with regard to Guantanamo. It's what I call Guantanamo 2. On Monday, March 28th, there was a very important, critical argument in the Supreme Court concerning Guantanamo. The case is called Hamdan, H-A-M-D-A-N, Hamdan, and it was argued on Monday, March 28th. Concerned the detainee who was picked up in Afghanistan. He was kept in Guantanamo for 4 years, and unlike most of the other detainees in Guantanamo, he was also brought before, or is about to be brought before, what's called a military commission. Normally, the 500 Guantanamo or so detainees are not brought before military commissions. That's for trying so-called war crimes. The military commissions were set up by the president shortly after 9/11. The Center for Constitutional Rights has been fighting them since that time, believing they were nothing but ad hoc tribunals. The president sets the rules. They allowed for completely secret trials, coerced testimony, testimony from torture, no appeals except to the president. The judges are all handpicked. There's a lot wrong, in other words, with these military commissions. In any case, Hamdan was brought before a military commission and challenged the right of the president to try him before military commissions. His claim basically is that you can't make up a court like this. You have to use regular courts. You can't make up a special court. And the charges you have against me, which are conspiracy, are not even war crimes. You're writing the charges, Mr. President. So those are the basic allegations around constitutionality of a military commission. Hamdan's lawyers, who the center is working with, are saying two things, really. One is you can't use special kangaroo courts like this. And secondly, you can't make up the charges. While that case was pending in the Supreme Court, before it was argued, the next set of issues came up, because what did our Congress do? And we've discussed this on the program before. They passed the Detainee Treatment Act. The Detainee Treatment Act was passed, unfortunately, with the cooperation of a lot of Democrats. It's called the Graham-Levin Amendment. But what it does is it strips the courts of jurisdiction to hear Guantanamo cases. So think about it. The case is pending in the Supreme Court. Along comes Congress, bill signed by the president, and says, the president wants to read it. Oh, no, Supreme Court, you can no longer hear the case of Hamdan. We're taking away the jurisdiction of the court to hear this case, and we're taking it away from all the courts to hear any of the Guantanamo cases. That's the legislation members of Congress, many of them apparently, think they may have passed. Many others say, well, they didn't really mean to do that. That's not what counted here. But in any case, so that's the setting for this argument on March 28th. Are these military commissions constitutional? Can you charge people with crimes that aren't really traditional war crimes that are made up by the president? And secondly, can you take away jurisdiction from the federal courts and particularly a Supreme Court when a case is pending? And when you say take away jurisdiction, what it really means is can you actually strip the courts of jurisdiction and therefore strip it from hearing what are called habeas corpus petitions? A habeas petition is simply the most important right that really we have in the United States and that people have in most countries. It's the right to say to the government, after they grab you by the scruff of the neck and toss you into the can, to say to the government in a court, why am I being held? And the government has to justify in the court why you are being held. What the Detainee Treatment Act did was say to the courts, you can no longer hear habeas corpus petitions, essentially. So this was really, on Monday, a historic argument. There were only eight judges sitting in the court, eight justices. Justice Roberts, who's the newly appointed Chief Justice, was not permitted to sit on the case because Justice Roberts had actually decided the case in favor of the president when he was on the appeals court a number of months before. And just an interesting aside about that. He made that decision upholding the president's power to use military commissions at a time when he was being considered for the Supreme Court, but no one in the world knew it except for President Bush and Alberto Gonzalez, who was the attorney general. So you understand what happened here. While he's sitting on a case that's actually a case against the president, Justice Roberts is meeting with the president to decide, the president is deciding whether he's going to appoint Roberts to the Supreme Court. Well, you know, Roberts may have gone against us and in favor of the president no matter what happened, but it certainly doesn't look too good to see that the guy who became the Supreme Court Chief Justice is sitting with the president discussing his nomination while he's sitting on the most important single case in the last couple of years on the president's powers to detain people. So that's one very interesting peculiarity of this case. A second one, of course, is when you go into that court and there's now eight justices sitting there because Roberts removes himself from the bench. There is still sitting on that bench a long-term justice named Justice Scalia. Very conservative, you'd have to say right-wing, reads the Constitution as it was written. He would probably think that that slaves probably that should only get two-thirds of a vote. I mean, if it wasn't for the 14th Amendment to the Constitution and the 15th Amendment saying they were full citizens of the United States. Scalia sitting on the court. Now, why do I mention Scalia? Scalia, a few days actually, prior to that argument, is in Germany, and he's giving a speech to some German lawyers and some others. And he starts talking about what he thinks of Guantanamo and constitutional rights on Guantanamo. And he basically says, paraphrasing, anybody who thinks that people on Guantanamo, which are the very case that's about to be argued in a week or two in front of him, anybody who thinks there's any constitutional rights in Guantanamo is crazy. So there you got a judge, a justice of the Supreme Court, giving his opinion about a case before he's read the briefs, before he's heard the arguments, and before he's gone into the conference with the other justices to decide how to decide that case.
Well, he also said, Michael, he said, and the reason you're crazy if you think these people have any rights at all is that my son was on the battlefield in Iraq, like Iraq had something to do with it.
Right. And what he says, if my son was picked up and held as a prisoner, he wouldn't have any rights. Or if someone who was picked up, who was shooting at my son, I think he said, they wouldn't have any rights either. Well, you're right, Michael. It doesn't have anything to do with this. These people were picked up as alleged terrorists, not as people on the battlefield, and they were held in interrogation camps, not in prisoner of war camps, and they were tortured to get the so-called truth, which turns out to be lies, out of them. The two have nothing to do with each other, but it also shows you that this guy is thinking of a personal interest in the case, which should be another reason for disqualifying Scalia. In any case, five former military people who were involved in submitting some of the amicus briefs to the court on this case actually asked Scalia to disqualify himself from the case. He did not. So there's the scenario. March 28th, it's the morning, it's a special argument, an hour and a half, the courtroom is jammed, Roberts is off the bench, Scalia is sitting on the bench, the lawyer for our side, Brahamden, is a man named Neil Keitel, who's a professor at Georgetown. He gives an excellent, excellent argument, and it looks like at the you hesitate to ever guess in these cases. You don't know how they were going to come out, but they were very, very concerned. Five of them were. Of course, the three that usually go against us, who are Justice Thomas, Justice Scalia and the new Justice Alito, we're probably going to lose those three. Yeah. But the other five, it looks like on two issues, we're going to actually be able to pick up enough votes to hopefully say, one, that the Congress passing of the Detainee Treatment Act to try and strip the court of jurisdiction, it cannot do that, and that that's the equivalent of a suspension of the writ of habeas corpus. And the Constitution is very clear on this. You can only suspend the writ, and only Congress can do it, in case of an invasion or a war. And they never said anything about that in passing the act stripping the Supreme Court. They never said this is an invasion, this is a type of situation where we have to strip the court. And you'll hear an excerpt that we're going to play of that particular piece. Paul Clement, who's arguing for the government, and then Justice Souter, who's talking to Paul Clement about, can Congress have really meant to strip the courts of habeas corpus jurisdiction? And Clement is arguing, the lawyer for the government, they can do it even though they did it inadvertently, which in other words, they didn't really mean to do it. They didn't say it was an invasion or a war, but they did it in effect, so they did it. And Souter is then saying, what are you talking about? This is the most important protection of any citizen in the world, and you're saying Congress did it inadvertently? You don't really mean that. So it's just a short excerpt, but it's an interesting one.
I'm sorry.
May I just ask this, just clarify? When they do take away some jurisdiction of some habeas corpus claims, do you defend that in part as a permissible exercise of the power to suspend the writ, or do you say it is not a suspension of the writ?
I think both, ultimately. I mean,
it
I don't
can't
think...
be both.
Well, I don't see why I can't have alternative arguments here as we're anywhere else, Justice Stevens. We think that Congress, in this action, did not do anything that triggers the suspension of the writ. But if you think that it did, I think...
That's your position. They did not suspend the writ. You're not arguing that it's a justifiable suspension of the writ.
Well, I think that the terms of the suspension clause would be satisfied here because of the exigencies of 9/11. If the question is, am I taking the position that Congress consciously thought that it was suspending the writ, then I would say no. And if you think in order for there to be a valid suspension, Congress has to do it consciously, then I think you could see why the arguments are mutually exclusive. My view would be that if Congress sort of stumbles upon a suspension of the writ, but the preconditions are satisfied, that would still be constitutionally valid. So I think that may be the disagreement.
Isn't there a pretty good argument that a suspension of the writ of Congress is just about the most stupendously significant act that the Congress of the United States can take, and therefore we ought to be at least a little slow to accept your argument that it can be done from pure inadvertence?
Well, a couple of things, Justice Souter. I would agree with you if what we were talking about is suspending the right as to citizens within the continental United States. But all Congress did here is restore the law to the understanding of the law that had prevailed for 200 years. Now, this court obviously took a bit different view in
Rasool. If we have to get to the issue, in accordance with Justice Breyer's question, whether or not the writ of habeas corpus was suspended, you are leaving us with the position of the United States that the Congress may validly suspend it inadvertently. Is that really your position?
I think at least if you're talking about the extension of the writ to enemy combatants
held inside
the territory of the United States.
Now, wait a minute. The writ is the writ. There are not two writs of habeas corpus for some cases and for other cases. The rights that may be asserted, the rights that may be vindicated, will vary with the circumstances, but jurisdiction over habeas corpus is jurisdiction over habeas corpus. And it seems to me that the position you have taken is that if, at the end of the day, we have to reach the question that Justice Breyer described, the answer to that question may be, yes, the writ of habeas corpus was suspended by inadvertence. Congress did not intend to do it. Is that really your position?
No, Justice Souter. My point is not inadvertence. It's whether they have to say or incant any magic words that they are now invoking their power to
surely set forth a procedure which amounts to a suspension of the writ. And if that procedure is done in a state of insurrection or invasion, that would constitute a suspension of the writ, even though they don't say we are suspending the writ of habeas corpus.
That is my point, and there's nothing inadvertent
here. Is it
here.
Also your point when there is no insurrection or invasion?
Well, then any effort to suspend the writ would be invalid. But this is not a case where there's any question of...
Perhaps that's something that a court ought to inquire into when it gets into the question of congressional intent.
That was a segment of the Supreme Court argument in the Hamden v. Rumsfeld case on March 28th. You were listening to the government's lawyer, Paul Clement, as well as Justice Souter.
There was a burglary at the Brecht Forum March 16th. We have Liz Maestros, the executive director of the Brecht Forum, here to talk about it. It was an extremely suspicious, quite likely FBI or police operation. Liz is here to talk about what happened and what they're doing about it. Joining us also is Margaret Ratner Kunstler, who's an attorney here in the city of New York. She was on the staff at the Center for Constitutional Rights in the 80s when the government was breaking in to organizations that were active in the Central American Solidarity Movement. Liz, Margaret, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Liz, let's start with you. Can you tell us what happened with this burglary on March 16th at the Brecht Forum?
After we closed up, we left, and when we came back the next day, our computers were gone. That's the most suspicious part of it. We didn't first see a sign of a break-in, but looking more closely, we see that they did come in one of our office windows. This was the computer that held our database and lists of all our mailing lists. It was. They took two computers, a boombox, shopping cart. That was it.
And I understand that there were other, even more valuable electronic items there that they might have taken that they didn't, and they just took the computers with the names of the supporters of the Brecht Forum, the financial supporters. I mean, they went for the money, in a sense.
Yeah, looks that way. Of course, we can't really know for sure. They did come into the office. It could have been an ordinary burglary, so we have to be vigilant on all fronts.
You know, it could have been, and we certainly don't want to cry wolf. But I tell you, historically, and I'm going to ask you about this in a second, Margaret, the FBI and other secret police operatives broke into the Central American Solidarity activists organizations in the early 80s. When I had a radical law firm in Detroit in the late 60s and early 70s, they regularly paid visits to my law firm. So even though we don't want to cry wolf, I don't want to give them the benefit of the doubt either.
Liz, I'm interested in, if you talk about what the Brecht Forum is and why would they be interested in these files?
Oh, okay. Yeah, we're kind of a left social, cultural, and educational center. Almost all of our programs are critical of government policy in one way or another. It's definitely a progressive center.
I understand you had a couple of programs just before the break-in, one with Chesa Boudin on Venezuela and another one on Palestine.
Yes.
And what would be in the files? Lists of supporters, lists of donors?
Our mailing list. We have a mailing list of over close to 20,000 people who receive our schedules.
The Brecht Forum has been around for some 30 years. It's really a left cultural political institution here in New York City. If they were going to target something, this would be right up on the top of the list, wouldn't it?
Well, if they're wanting to monitor people's emails, the kind of things that we hear they're doing these days, this is the kind of information that might be very useful.
Margaret Ratner Kunstler, what was your experience when you were a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights with respect to the secret police burglarizing movement groups in the early 80s?
Well, at that time, there were over 100 break-ins of various institutions that were involved in solidarity work with Central America. We suspected, though, that it was not the FBI agents themselves who were doing the break-ins, but perhaps Salvadorans who were Contras, who were trained in this School of the Americas, perhaps, who were carrying out those activities. And the reason that we thought that was because given the history of black bag jobs in this country, it would be unlikely that the FBI would risk a Felt and Miller type arrest. That Felt and Miller were arrested after black bag jobs in the 60s and were prosecuted. So we think that from that point on, the FBI themselves did not carry out these activities, but rather had surrogates carrying them out. The only time that the FBI actually breaks in on their own, and Michael Ratner and I had this experience together, is when they lose a piece of their equipment. They are very insane about having lost a piece of equipment. They must get it back because there's something about macho about losing, you know, your gun. So if that happens, they themselves take over to get it back. And Michael and I had that experience when we had a client who had a bumper beeper on their car, and we took the bumper beeper off the car, placed it in a safe in an office that we had at 351 Broadway, and the next day we got to the office and we found that the safe had been lowered out the window. So that was the FBI themselves getting back their equipment. But
and I should say, Margie, you know, it was not a small safe. This safe was 5 feet high, was it, Margie?
It was a
big safe. I mean, you couldn't lift it off the ground. One person could not lift the safe off. The bumper beeper is about 3 inches wide, 10 inches long, solid black. It sticks on the back of your car with a magnet. It's a tracking device.
It's an earlier version of EasyPass.
Right, and they can follow you around with that.
It's an earlier version because at that point they needed two cars. Now they only need one because they had to triangulate at that point, and now they don't have to do that with the satellite.
So think about what we have here. We have that burglary at our law office in the 70s. It's in the 70s, Margie, right?
Yes.
Then we go to the 80s, and we have all of the Central America stuff that the center tracked. Margie was head of the Movement Support Network. And now we're going into the 2000 period where we're having the Brecht Forum having been burglarized. There's other burglaries that have been documented across the country. And then, of course, there's a broader context. The president thinks he has the right, actually, as part of national security and going after terrorists. The so-called warrantless wiretapping includes the right to do black bag jobs, as they were called then, or the right to enter people's homes and take material out of them, look at them, Xerox, whatever they want. Later in this program, we'll be talking more about NSA spying, warrantless wiretapping that the president has authorized, and particularly the recent revelations that he may be, and the agents may be overhearing, attorney-client conversations.
Well, and the week before the burglary, when the Patriot Act was passed overwhelmingly by both the Republicans and their Democratic supporters, part of the Patriot Act says you can come in and do a sneak and peek. You can't actually steal something, but you can download, and you don't have to tell anybody what you did. Now they're taking it a step further by sneaking and stealing. Liz Mestris from the Brecht Forum, did you back up any of the data that was stolen?
Oh, yes. We have backups of data. Fortunately, we would be in rough shape if we hadn't. And also, I mean, we immediately put out an announcement to our email list, you know, that this had happened, and we've had people offering to help replace the stolen equipment and that kind of thing.
You beat me to my next question. If people want to help here, the Brecht's got a website. If people will get their pens and pencils out, I'll ask you, Liz, what is the website for the Brecht Forum?
Oh, it's www.brechtforum.org.
And I understand that there was a well-attended community meeting of people that wanted to publicize this and get further information and also check with each other on what's been happening to other groups in the city. Can you tell us about that meeting?
That was just very supportive. We had a meeting. It was about 45 people came from a lot of different organizations around the city that have done work with us in the past and continue to. And so we had a very long discussion of how we have to not be intimidated by these things. I mean, the Patriot Act itself is an act of intimidation to people who want to discuss their views.
Margie, why don't you describe some of what kind of work you did to try and document this stuff and what kind of actions you recommended and what you told people to do?
One of the major things that we told people to do and what Liz is doing most effectively is to publicize it. We found that publicizing the activities prepared other groups for the possibility of it happening, made people less afraid when it did happen, and part of made them feel like they were part of a community and they weren't standing alone. What we did was we began to keep records of the various break-ins so we could report them in a group to the media and get coverage that way. And we felt that if we kept publicizing it, we might even be able to stop it. But if we couldn't stop it, at the very least, we could make people feel more comfortable about working in an environment where there was such avid intelligence gathering occurring right around them.
I want to remind our listeners that we have Liz Mestris, the executive director of the Brecht Forum, just suffered a recent burglary there, a suspicious burglary, and Margaret Ratner Kunstler, New York City attorney, former staff member at the Center for Constitutional Rights. And we've been talking about the March 16th suspicious burglary of the Brecht Forum.
And what about backing up files and things like that?
Oh, absolutely. I think that goes with anybody who works with computers. For whatever reasons, it's always necessary to have backups.
I mean, you have to back up but then not leave the tapes right next to the computer.
That's correct.
We really come a long way. In the 60s, when I was part of a movement law firm in Detroit, We had a $500 sound burglar alarm, and the thing sent out sound waves throughout our office. And we'd lock it up at night, you know, and it would detect any kind of movement, motion in the office. And every couple of weeks, the damn thing would go off, and we couldn't figure out why. And I thought, you know, maybe there was a mouse in the place, or maybe it was a butterfly. We just didn't understand it. And we didn't understand it for years until Dick Sobel, who's a member of the board of the Center for Constitutional Rights, brought a lawsuit against various police entities in the state of Michigan. And sure enough, we got all the records, and these guys were regularly breaking into our law office. Why? Because we were like attorneys for the movement. And we had records on draft resistors, and we had records on anti-war protests and protesters. We had records on men in the military, women in the military mm-hmm. that were opposing the war in Vietnam. And they would come in and take a peek at those records and at our attorney files, which leads me to a question to you, Michael. I thought it was really not cricket for them to be looking into the files of attorneys and their clients back in the 60s. What are they doing with attorneys now?
You know, a couple of things. I think we have to look at this thing historically in a way. I mean, obviously they burglarized Margie's in my office in the 70s. Then they did the stuff in the 80s. A lot of that was at least arguably not authorized by law. There was no special foreign surveillance court that gave you a special secret warrant to go into people's homes to take materials. There was some belief that the president claimed he had some authority to do it, but eventually got struck down. Today, of course, there's two claims of authority to actually do these burglaries. One is under the Foreign Surveillance Intelligence Act, which is the one that allows Foreign Surveillance Intelligence Court gives you secret sneak and peek warrants. You can go into people's homes. And the other is the broad authority asserted by the president under claiming that he can do warrantless wiretapping as well as warrantless black bag jobs. As part of that latter power, the center brought a case against the National Security Agency claiming that our attorneys were wiretapped and maybe more surveilled in terms of their email as well as who knows about black bag jobs. We claimed that our attorneys, because of their contact with everybody at Guantanamo, et cetera, were deeply involved in the opposing the government on these issues, that they were unlawfully wiretapped. And it wasn't speculation. We figured we hit the targets. We figured that's why they didn't go to the court, because they were doing attorneys. A week ago, or approximately a week ago, last 10 days, the government came out with a statement, a 55-page letter to the Senate, answering a series of questions. And the only one they answered substantively was they said it may be that when we're wiretapping people from the United States to abroad or vice versa, that we pick up or overhear attorney-client conversations. And they said there's nothing wrong with that. That's legal for us to do, essentially.
Yeah, and conversations with you and your doctor as well. I think they said they want to do that. Of course, that's what got them in trouble with Daniel Ellsberg.
But, of course, the Democrats have, as usual, laid down on it, most of them, other than Feingold censure and a couple of other things. Another couple of questions for both Liz and Margie. Liz, I don't think we've talked about the reason the Brecht Forum has its name, have we? Well, who's it named after? Who was this guy, Brecht?
That's Bertolt Brecht. It actually happened because we were originally the New York Marxist School, and we still are the New York Marxist School. We took the Brecht Forum name when we became incorporated. But we took the name because it was the first play that was performed at our first space back in the 70s was a Brecht play. And so we went on to name the auditorium the Brecht Auditorium. And so we just were kind of accustomed to the name. And we all love Brecht. And we also like the mixture of art and politics that Brecht stood for.
Listeners will know Brecht from the famous Three-Penny Opera and the Mack the Knife song. Brecht was a German socialist revolutionary who came and lived in the United States temporarily. The Congress didn't like his politics, and he had a confrontation with them, got himself deported, didn't he?
Yes.
I'm trying to look at the scenario of who could have done like the Brecht Forum burglary and others. One is obviously was just a straight burglary, but in the context of what we know and who the mailing list was, the politics of the Brecht Forum, that seems unlikely. The other thing you said, Marge, that was unlikely it was the FBI directly. Can you just spin that out a little bit? What did we find in Central America again? Who was doing it?
Well, we never got absolute confirmation, but from enough sightings, there were a couple of sightings and a couple of descriptions, we felt that it was Salvadoran Contras who were trained in the School of the Americas who were doing that work because they were the absolute safe people for the FBI to go to in this kind of context. So it would have to be someone who was trained in police intelligence work. That would be required. And I don't think it would be actually someone who was an FBI agent. So it's interesting to figure out who these people might be at this time. There certainly are other people who have been schooled in the School of the Americas that might potentially still be used in that category.
I totally agree with your overview on it. I think their MO is they put the word out that they'd like to see this done. That's what's known in the kind of counter-revolutionary community. The FBI itself doesn't want any fingerprints on the job because for obvious reasons. But I think that that's the explanation, say, about how Malcolm X was assassinated or Martin Luther King. It's not done directly, but it's done purposefully and, you know, very effectively.
Well, what I think happened, I remember, Margie, in the 80s with Central America, they were, let's say, investigating an anti-war group. They would hook up with these guys, like from Salvador and everything else, and they would just say, well, you know, boy, it would sure be good if we had these records, right, or something. Is that, I mean, that's the way you think
it
works?
Well, I don't think that they were careful about it at all, right, in their personal conversations. There was no reason to be. But it was clear to us that there were these odd people who were not necessarily FBI agents who went to all of the meetings, the public meetings of these groups. And it was probably the same people who infiltrated, who were around, who carried out these activities. And they definitely were police agents. They were not just criminals off the street.
Well, one thing, you know, what reminds me that we ought to do is if there's people who are out there, who are organizations particularly, that issues like this have happened to, that have burglaries, they should probably be in touch with certainly the center and if not Liz as well regarding those kinds of things, just so we can see if there's any pattern even within New York City.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to reiterate what you said, Marge, that the way to defeat this is just shine the spotlight of public opinion on it. That's the way to defeat it. And you certainly don't get paranoid. You know that they're out there not doing us any good, but we don't do anything illegal. We don't advocate anything illegal. What we do is open and public. The Breck Forum has been around for 30 years doing stuff like this. We're going to continue to do what we do, and we're going to shine the light of public opinion on people who do the kind of things to us that they've done. Liz Mestris from the Breck Forum, give us that website one more time, will you please?
Okay, it's www.breckforum.org.
I'd like to thank you very much for coming on Law and Disorder. Margaret Ratton, Kunstler, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
Tens of thousands of students across the country staged walkouts last week, protesting recent immigration reform proposals in the House that introduced sweeping changes for undocumented immigrants. More than 8,000 students walked out of their L.A. County schools and thousands more in Nevada, Arizona, Utah, and Texas. In Washington, D.C., activists and religious leaders also protested measures in House Bill 4437 that would make it a crime for religious and charitable groups to aid undocumented workers. Joining us now is Jim Lafferty, Executive Director of the Los Angeles Chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
Welcome, Jim Lafferty, to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jim. I'm here with Michael Ratner. I want to remind our listeners that Jim Lafferty had the original Lawyers Guild show out in Los Angeles. Jim is the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild in L.A. He's a former national director years ago, and in the interest of full disclosure, a former partner of mine in Detroit in the 60s. Jim, you're right in the center of the immigrant protest movement out in Los Angeles. We're real glad to have you on the phone to talk about what's going on out there. We've just been joined by your friend and ours, Heidi Bogosian.
Hi, Heidi.
Hi, Heidi. Michael Ratner's here.
Hi, Michael.
Jim, can you tell us in a nutshell what's at stake and why we've seen over a million people pour out in the streets of L.A. protesting these laws that have been proposed in Congress?
Yeah. The Latino movement here in Los Angeles has been well organized for a number of years. Your listeners may remember that one Prop 187 was on the ballot and passed some 11 years ago, I guess it is now, 12 years ago. Over 100,000 people at that time poured into the streets. But to have nearly a million or over a million pour into the streets last Saturday was really exciting and thrilling. Families were there. Everybody was there, really. It was an extraordinary display. All of the elected officials around had to show up. A mayor, of course, who is Latino himself, was one of those who addressed the rally. And that, of course, turned inspired the students. And we've had, on one given day alone, on this past Monday, we had upwards of 30,000 students just from the Los Angeles Unified School District walk out. But, of course, throughout the country, and especially here in Southern California, school districts all over Southern California have been walking out, and that continues up until today. And it's there are more plans for that next week. The authorities here in most cases have responded fairly harshly to that. The school board, the school principals initially, almost to a person, violated our state education law, which makes it clear that you can't suspend someone for the mere act of being truant. After all, that would be contradictory. And yet hundreds and hundreds of students have been suspended, and in some cases for 4 or 5 days. Some students have been transferred contrary to the law or expelled contrary to the law. Tickets, the amount of $250, are being given out en masse by the local police. In some cases, the security guards have been quite brutal. Some schools were enlightened, and they followed a policy enunciated by our school board a couple of months ago, which said that in the face of walkouts, you shouldn't lock the doors and make kids break windows or climb over the fence to get out of school. You should go with them and try to keep it orderly and try to keep it peaceful and make it an educational experience and protect the safety of the children. The school principals and teachers that did do that in a handful of cases had wonderful results. But in most cases, it's as I say, it's been a struggle between the students to get out and to protest and their administrators trying to prevent them from doing so. Parents, in large measure, have been supporting these students as well, often walking out with them, in some cases getting their truancy tickets directly themselves. And there's no let-up in sight. They feel their strength, as they should. They understand that the demographics of this country are on their side. They're very familiar with the details of the Sensenbrenner bill, in many cases, as well with the Senate bill. And they know damn well what's happened to their parents over the years. They've watched their parents, who, if they're undocumented, looking always over their shoulder at La Migra. They know about the insults. They know about the fact that they pay taxes and don't get any benefits from it, et cetera, et cetera. These kids, perhaps unlike the young people of my generation when I was 14 and 15 and 16, are not prepared to take it anymore, and they've made it very clear. Their protests have almost always been peaceful, if militant, and I'm very proud of them.
Jim, this is Heidi here.
Hi, Heidi.
Hi. I called your hotline and was really impressed with the services that the Guild chapter is offering. Can you describe those for our audience?
Yeah, I'm very proud of what we did do. What happened was, somebody, I'm sure, well-intentioned, put out all over the websites and the listservs that the young folks are using here a statement attributed to the Lawyers Guild, which we never made, which says everybody has an absolute right as a student to walk out of school whenever they want to participate in a political protest. Of course, that's not quite the case. And advising any student with any problem resulting therefrom to call our office. Well, you don't want to know. That's been the only downside. It's been quite a nightmare. In fact, we're getting calls from the tri-state area and from and school. I mean, it's all over the place out here. And we simply couldn't keep up with it. So we immediately convened all the different bar groups in town, set up a committee. We've opened up, as you say, two hotlines, one in Spanish and one in English, where we can gather the data from people about their suspensions and truancy tickets. We're training lawyers to handle those truancy cases. We're meeting with the judge at traffic court. We've set up a separate website that provides Know Your Rights information and which is interactive, where the student or parent can indicate what's happened to them, their ticket number or their suspension for what school. And we've hired some people part-time, now students and others, to get back to them. And I will say we did succeed in convincing the lawyers for the school board and then the school board itself that their principals were violating the law when they were suspending students for the mere act of walking out of school. A directive has now been sent to all the principals directing them to reconsider all of those suspensions. To the extent that that works fine, to the extent that it doesn't, the lawyers we're training are prepared to go to court to get their students' records cleaned up and are prepared to represent them on all the truancy tickets. And, of course, our legal observing program is growing, too. And wherever possible, although it's all over the place, we're sending legal observers out to be with the students when they're out in the streets.
Now, Monday is a national day of solidarity all around the country.
Cesar Chavez and just solidarity with all this. Yeah, today a lot of people are celebrating Cesar Chavez Day. Today they also celebrated it last Monday. It's becoming a month-long celebration of Cesar Chavez Day. But you're quite right, on Monday again, and again here in Los Angeles next Thursday, we expect thousands of students to descend on the school board, where the school board next meets, to demand two things. One, that the school board come out strongly in opposition to the Sensenbrenner bill and any bill that criminalizes undocumented immigrants further. Secondly, demanding that those who are improperly suspended or have their records cleaned up automatically by the school.
Jim, the Sensenbrenner bill is really an odious bill. It's as ugly as the man himself. But the other bill that's been proposed isn't much good either. Can you tell our listeners about that?
These guest worker programs that are floating around in the Senate or that Bush has backed, I think the reason for backing is pretty clear. You've got an awful lot of corporate America, which, of course, are Bush's best friends, that want these low-wage immigrant workers who have a hard time organizing, a hard time striking if the conditions aren't good. There's a big demand for those workers. Anyone who's seen the movie A Day Without a Mexican might get some idea of what I'm talking about. Bush is in a hard place between the rightist right wing of his party, which simply wants to build 700-mile fences and make it a more serious felony and make it a crime to even offer bread or water to an undocumented immigrant, and some of his employer friends who want this cheap pool of labor. The bill talking about guest worker programs and all the rest with the possibility of leading the citizenship might look good to the casual observer on paper, but if you know anything about the lives of immigrants and what they have to deal with, you understand how impractical that really is. And yet, with upwards of 12 million undocumented immigrants in the country, they're going to have to do something.
Well, it holds out the carrot that these people can eventually get citizenship.
Which
but it says if you've committed a fraud, you can't get it. And an undocumented immigrant has to really say he's got a Social Security number when he doesn't, stuff like that. It really is a fake carrot, isn't it?
It is a fake carrot, and it might benefit some small numbers of persons, but it wouldn't begin to address the problem, which I think can only be addressed by legalizing those who've been in the country who've already paid more taxes than any benefits they could ever hope to reach and receive, who collectively pay some $7 billion a year into the Social Security fund that they can't collect. I think somebody just did a recent study and discovered that all the money that immigrants, documented and undocumented, pay into, about 5% of them can they enjoy by way of an emergency room maybe or something.
I mean, I think the irony is that the Anglos ripped off that country from the Hispanics to begin with. So the one question is, whose country is it?
Well, that's what I often say to any colleagues out here who get nervous about, quote unquote, all the Mexicans. And I say, hey, they're just taking the country back that we stole from it. They're doing it block by block.
And moreover, the neoliberal economic policies, these people can't make a living wage in Mexico. They're forced here.
We did a call-in show last night on KPFK here on our Lawyers Guild show, and a number of callers very astutely made that point. If Western capital, U.S. capital in this case, first despoils and takes all the resources and sets it up so they have a pool of cheap labor, they impoverish a country. So now what are the people in that country to do but to go to where the better-paying jobs are? Many of us have commented on the inequity of allowing capital to move freely around the world with the seemingly no obstacles at all in the search of cheap labor, but labor can't move around the world in the search of a decent job without being called a criminal. That's understood. I talk to a lot of these high school students. They're very sophisticated. They may not know about certain issues, but they sure as heck know about this because it affects mom and dad and uncle and everybody else and their future.
We've been talking with Jim Lafferty, who's the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild out in Los Angeles. Jim has been on the front line of the struggle out there, and we're really getting a report back on what's going on. Jim, any closing thoughts on the situation?
Well, just one last thing I think would be interesting for your listeners there to know. I don't know quite what the situation is in New York. I haven't been able to stick my head up to see. But if it's anything at all like here, your station might want to do what we're doing today. I'm leaving this phone interview to go downtown, where KPFK is sponsoring a town meeting where we expect hundreds and hundreds of students to come. The purpose of the meeting is to listen to these students. It'll be broadcast live on KPFK. I'll be there and others will be there to explain to the students what their rights are and to help them link up with the resources that they need. It's a good service of Pacifica out here on the West Coast, and if the need is there, I'd urge it on your folks there, too.
I wanted to tell listeners that this Monday, today, April 3rd, happening right now at 10 a.m., but should be still going on by the time the show is over with, there is a press conference at New York City Hall with several groups, Families for Freedom, the Immigrant Defense Project, Immigration Equality, many others. And if you're nearby and have a chance to check it out, please do.
Now, Heidi, I have a question for you. Jim has a hotline out there in for California. If you're a student in New York City, what do? Where do you call?
You can certainly call the New York City chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. We'll have that number up on our website. And you can certainly call the National Lawyers Guild, 212-679-5100, and we'll try to link you up with someone who can help you.
But are there ways for other people to participate in this? What's expected of us?
Well, we're asking all of our lawyers here in the Lawyers Guild and in the Latino bars and other associations we work with here to be at the schools on Monday and every day to the extent they can. And we're doing that. We have 50 high schools here in L.A. I can't say we're covering each one of them all day. And going with the students as they leave, as are some of the teachers more. We've also met with some of the principals. We're talking with various school board members. And parents and teachers and lawyers now are more and more walking with the students and helping them in their protest and showing their solidarity with the students in this protest. In some cases, these students are, and they know it, committing acts of civil disobedience, and they're prepared to pay the consequences where the consequences are just and proper. I would urge all of your listeners to find out what's going on at your own school. And make it your business, if you can, to get to that school and show your support, even if you're not an attorney. It doesn't matter. Show your support by walking with the students and wherever they're going. Let them know that they're not alone as they take on the system in this very, very moving way and very powerful way, certainly here in Los Angeles.
So to all our listeners out there, today, Monday, this is going on. If you live near a high school, if you have friends who do, get out there now and support what is going on this special Monday, in which we're opposing these terrible pieces of legislation snaking their way through our U.S. Congress.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you, Jim. This was really exciting. It's amazing work you've been doing there.
Oh, well, thank you for all your work. And it's a brighter day for all of us when we see these folks on the move, because whether we're immigrants or not, we stand to benefit when our immigrant sisters and brothers stand up for their rights, too.
You bet. Thanks,
thank you,
guys.
Jim.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye. We also have with us Cynthia Anderson Barker, a civil rights attorney in Los Angeles and former president of the National Lawyers Guild LA chapter. Welcome, Cynthia.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you guys.
We've been talking with a colleague of yours, Jim Lafferty, about last week's walkouts, mm-hmm. and we know that you have a history of representing protesters in LA. Can you put into context what last week's protests were like compared to what you've seen there before?
Sure. I mean, in the past, with all kinds of demonstrations, including anti-war protests, everything's been pretty well organized in advance for the Lawyers Guild and the organizers. We know if there's going to be civil disobedience, we generally know about it. We plan and prepare. But this time, these walkouts have been totally spontaneous and organic. It was a surprise to all of us. It caught us all off guard.
That's a surprise you like, isn't it?
Yeah, it was the best surprise we've had in many a year. I mean, people went to the demonstration with 500,000 people, all our legal observers, our attorneys, our law students, and they just walked away.
Did you say 500,000 people?
More than 500,000. The L.A. Times reported 500,000.
Come on, seriously?
Seriously, for L.A.? That
L.A.? Well, that's probably one of the biggest demonstrations in the United States in the last few years.
For L.A., it's definitely the biggest. It's a huge movement out there. We're getting many phone calls, lots of requests for help, because these youth are being ticketed for truancy and loitering.
Was there a massive police presence?
You know, there was a massive police presence, and we've dealt with the LAPD on numerous occasions, suing them particularly during the DNC for shooting protesters with less than lethal weapons. But at this event, we had, again, the Lawyers Guild out there in full force. We saw them on the streets, but they were not responding to any provocation, if there was any. They were keeping their distance.
Why do you think that was? Because it was a younger group?
Well, I think the youth of the demonstrators had something to do with it, but I also think the fact that they've been sued around how they handle public demonstrations on a number of occasions over the last 5 years. So I think they're more careful now. They're more educated. They're training them more.
Now, Cynthia, didn't you win a huge settlement 2 years ago in a case?
We did. During the DNC, when we had large crowds in the streets who did not disperse when they were ordered to or just were in the street, the LAPD dispersed the crowd by shooting into the crowd with less than lethals. On Saturday, the law enforcement yelled out a dispersal order, but there were no less than lethal weapons displayed, and they were not in full riot gear.
And was the media present?
And the media was everywhere. And I think that's a deterrent, too, is having the press there and the fact that these were young protesters. But then again, on Saturday, it wasn't all youth. It was a mixed crowd. It was their parents. It was all sectors. It wasn't just the youth factor that made the police sort of back off.
And what kind of demands are people making?
Well, they're demanding the students are now going to be marching to the school board next week, demanding that they rescind all the loitering and truancy tickets that have been given out, that they dismiss those charges, and that the students be allowed to peacefully protest, and that they're asking the school board now to take a position on the Sensenbrenner bill. City Council took a position. Now the students want the school board to act.
They want the school board to come out against the
yes.
Sensenbrenner bill.
Yes, yes.
Now, are they actually in favor of some other kind of bill, or are they? What are they saying?
What they know is the Sensenbrenner bill makes it a felony to aid an immigrant, an undocumented worker. And so that has been a big focus of these student protesters. And some, of course, are demanding and asking for amnesty for those who are already here in the U.S.
And, of course, aiding an immigrant, if your son or your daughter or your father is an immigrant and you're living in the house and you make dinner for him, that's aiding an illegal immigrant, right?
Exactly.
Or an undocumented worker.
Exactly. And that language in that proposed legislation is causing all these students to rise up and act.
Now, today, Monday, there's more demonstrations have been called for. I know it's early in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of actions do you expect today?
Well, I think the students, again, will be walking out. I know they're planning to do that. I know the Spanish-language media here, however, and other media are encouraging them to stay in class. But they're in a movement. They're in motion, and they're all communicating with each other. So I expect there'll be a walkout, and they're going to walk to the school board, probably to our local city hall. And we're just not talking about Los Angeles. They're walking out to public buildings all over the outlying cities in L.A. County. I mean, they're walking to public places to protest.
Will you be out there with them, Cynthia?
Definitely, and all the Lawyers Guild lawyers who are able to will be out on the streets. But we're also organizing a legal defense network to deal with all the citations for loitering and truancy mm-hmm. that are coming up.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think is going to happen with the request to dismiss all of those?
Well, I think we have to deal with it at a much higher policy level than just one by one going to court and defending blocks of tickets. So I'm hoping that the city attorney or the DA, depending on the jurisdiction, will listen to our call, because we are organizing meetings with judges and city attorney and elected officials on this issue. There's thousands of these tickets.
The civil rights movement showed the way for the anti-war movement and everything else that followed.
Uh-huh.
These kids out in the street are showing the way for the rest of us on what we can do about a whole range of social problems. Let's first beat the one on immigration, though.
Cynthia, do you have any websites for our listeners to go to?
Of course, nlg-la.org is a website, but we also have a website we designed specifically for students, and it's www.studentwalkouts.info.
Great. Studentwalkouts, one word, .info.
Correct.
Perfect. It was wonderful to have you with us.
Thank you. We really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work. Thank you for your mama.
Law and Disorder wants to let our listeners know about a very special event coming up this Friday, April 7th, 6 p.m. It's going to be a National Lawyers Guild New York City Chapter Spring Fling. Cocktails, hors d'oeuvres, live entertainment, dancing. The event honors Frank Big Black Smith, an Attica defendant who died a couple of years ago, and attorney Elizabeth Fink, who also worked defending Attica defendants. It's at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, Synod Hall, 1047 Amsterdam Avenue. That's at 110th Street. If you'd like tickets, you can visit nlgnyc.org and get your tickets online. The next day at Columbia, there will also be a regional conference.
The Northeast region of the National Lawyers Guild is having a conference at Columbia Law School the next day, and we would invite our listeners to come. It's free for students. There's a nominal charge for other people. There's going to be workshops on military resistance, on animal rights, on the police crackdown against protesters in New York City, and a whole number of things. And that'll be at Columbia Law School on April 8th. And we invite all our listeners, friends of the Lawyers Guild, come to the regional conference at Columbia Law School. Where is that? 110th?
116th in Amsterdam, Columbia Law School.
Starting at 10 o'clock in the morning, April 8th.
There are going to be some great panelists, so really try to make it if you can.
It's all right when you love me, high and down. It's all right. Hey, hey, hey. It's all right. Hey. It's all right. It's all right. Wanna dance? It's alright. Feel like it wanna move.